я помню Тадванинский порт и вид парохода угрюмый, как шли мы по трапу на борт в холодные мрачные трюмы. От качки стонала зыка, ревела стихия морская, вставал на пути Магадан, столица Калмыцкого края.
Broadcast of episodes in Gulag History, a series of conversations with scholars, authors, and other public intellectuals about the history and legacy of the Soviet forced labor concentration camp and internal exile system. Episodes in Gulag History is a production of Gulag Many Days, Many Lives, a new multimedia exhibit on the history of the Gulag at gulaghistory.org. Created by the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University in conjunction with partners at the Gulag Museum in Perm, Russia, the International Memorial Society in Moscow, Russia, and with the generous financial support of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Episodes in Gulag History is supported by a special grant from the Kennan Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. I am your host, Steve Barnes, Assistant Professor of Russian History at George Mason University and author of a forthcoming book on the history of the Gulag. Over the coming months, it will be my pleasure to speak to a wide variety of guests about the history of the Gulag, but I can think of nobody better to start the series than my guest today. Please remember to join us online after the podcast, as our guest will be answering your questions on the gulaghistory.org blog. Lynn Viola is a professor of history at the University of Toronto and one of the world's foremost experts on the Stalinist experience in the Soviet countryside. She is the author of The Best Sons of the Fatherland and Peasant Rebels Under Stalin, along with being co-editor of the phenomenal document publication series The Tragedy of the Soviet Countryside. Lynn has long held a reputation in the field of Soviet history as one of the most indefatigable researchers, poring through archives and other sources near and far in pursuit of her histories. The same is certainly true for the book we will talk about today. In 2007, Oxford University Press released Lynn Viola's latest contribution, The Unknown Gulag, The Lost World of Stalin's Special Settlements. Lynn Viola, welcome to Episodes in Gulag History, and thank you for being our first guest.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Lynn, tell us, what is the Unknown Gulag?
The Unknown Gulag was an archipelago within the Gulag that first housed so-called kulaks and later a variety of social aliens and non-Russian ethnic groups. It was relatively separate from what we now know as the Gulag, and by that I mean the labor camps, in that this Gulag, so-called, consisted of what were called special settlements. In 1931, the high point for the Kulak population in the special settlements, there were roughly 2,000 such villages, mainly small population centers of about 100 families each, housing just under 2 million people. That is in 1931, and I should say statistics vary. The first population of the special settlements consisted of kulaks, and this term requires some explanation. It was often an arbitrary and a changing definition. But it represented, in practice, at this time, the traditional leadership of the village, that is, the most economically successful of the peasants, village elders, church elders, and even priests, sometimes members of the rural intelligentsia. The term kulak, though, originally comes from the word for fist, and before the revolution, it meant to take fist at peasants or a moneylender. In the Soviet period, it came to represent officially a range of peasants who could be classified roughly as rural capitalists. But again, in practice, when the repression of the village began in the late 1920s, people could be labeled a kulak for a range of arbitrary factors, including criticism of state policies.
So these kulaks, then, who wound up in these special settlements, I mean, what is it, in fact, that has led the Soviet state to send these people into something that has become a gulag?
Well, this is a complex and interesting question, and I think the answer is of necessity complex, so bear with me a minute because I want to give you a little bit of background on this.
Okay.
I think, first of all, it's necessary to contextualize the policy of what was called the liquidation of the Kulak as a class. Now, this policy arose in the context of the state's turn to wholesale collectivization of the Soviet peasantry. Collectivization was intended to socialize the peasantry, to create a system of socialized agriculture in the form of collective farms. The articulation and the implementation of this policy arose in what can only be described as a largely artificially created emergency atmosphere, which served to radicalize all policies aimed at the peasantry. So in this context, the Kulak became enemy number one and had no place in the collective farm. So the question then that arose at the time was, what do you do with the Kulak? Well, a policy was devised in late December 1929, early January 1930, which basically split Kulaks into three categories. The first category was considered the most dangerous, and originally was to encompass about 60,000 Kulak families. Heads of households were subject either to execution or internment in labor camps. The rest of the family was to be deported to the far reaches of the Soviet Union. Now, in actuality, some 30,000 people, mostly men, would be executed in 1930 and 1931, and the category as a whole would expand to roughly 250,000 arrests in all. The second category of Kulaks was to encompass the next so-called most dangerous and wealthiest Kulak families, and was originally intended to include 150,000 families who would be subject to deportation to the same areas as first category Kulaks. Now, in practice, this category also expanded, ranging in eventual numbers in 1930 and 31, again, depending on statistics, from something like 350,000 to 380,000 families. The final category encompassed all the rest of so-called Kulaks, the majority, who in 1930 were to be resettled outside collective farmlands. From 1931, this category, in fact, was subject to deportation. And all three categories were subject to property confiscation, so they lost everything that they owned. Now, in 1930, back to your question, the state was mainly interested in getting rid of the Kulak, removing them from the collective farms, if not the countryside as a whole. The policy was aimed at forestalling, first of all, the massive destruction of property and livestock which accompanied collectivization. Expropriation of Kulak property was meant to halt this destruction. Now, additionally, and probably even more importantly, the policy was used as a tool of intimidation to get peasants to join the collective farm. Either you join or you can be accused of being a Kulak and suffer the consequences. Now, by 1931, it became clear that there was another purpose for the Kulaks, and that is the Kulaks would be used as forced labor in regions where the state found it impossible to maintain a free labor force. These remote areas were regions rich in natural resources necessary for the ongoing industrialization effort. Remember, this was the time of the first five-year plan. So the state thought it had solved two problems in one stroke, removal of a class enemy and a major labor problem. The idea of deporting entire families meant that the labor force would be, in principle, continually replenished, and that non-working family members could engage in agriculture and thus, in a sense, pay for their incarceration, that is, subsidize the cost of Kulak internment. And a side benefit would be the colonization of these huge land expanses as the special settlements ranged over large areas of fairly empty territory.
So if I could simplify just a little and tell me if I'm getting this correct then in what you're saying, that there's a shift in the policy then between 1930 and 1931 that one might see going from sort of a push to a pull, which is to say in 1930 what I'm seeing you saying is that it's mostly about pushing Kulaks out of the village. And it's primarily aimed at the process in the village of trying to create collective farms and trying to eliminate resistance to the creation of collective farms. And they're not so concerned about what's going to happen to those Kulaks once they're out of the village, but let's just get them out and not worry about them. And then in 1931, as I'm seeing you're describing it, it becomes more and more a concern with this becomes a labor force that we can use to do something with them after they get out of the village. And so now, in the process of the first five-year plan, as the Soviet Union is moving on its path of quick and massive industrialization, as it's looking to open up new territories, and of course, as we know, this humongous geographic Soviet Union that on the whole is very, very underpopulated, very, very large areas with very, very small populations. The idea of maybe sending these people to some of these low populated areas in order to get access to materials there, be it timber, be it mines, be it anything like this, to get access to the natural resources. So it becomes a pull, in a sense, of trying to pull out of the village labor resources. Is this sort of correct in what I'm getting from your description?
Yeah, it is, Steve. I would say, though, that both elements of the equation, both the push and pull, were always there. It was just more emphasis initially was on the push factor.
Okay.
Because too much was going on at once. Remember, very, very quickly, they're putting tens of thousands of people on trains, in cattle cars, pushing them out. And so all of the emphasis at that point was simply getting these people out. And it took a while for things to settle down, for the state to even create all union institutions and committees to administer the special settlements. But both elements were there from the beginning.
Yeah. So if all of the emphasis is on getting them out, then what awaits for them when they arrive in their new places of settlement?
Well, nothing, to tell you the truth. What happened was that the people would be collected and brought to what was called a collection point. And so a number of village populations of kulaks would be pulled together, and then they would be shipped out. The first major stop would be in a town or city in the distant region of exile, so in the far north or in the Urals, Siberia, Kazakhstan. At that point, there would be a separation of the able-bodied, mostly the men, from the rest of the family. And it was a terrible point. They tried to keep this secret because they expected resistance. In the event, there wasn't a lot of it. People were, not in very good shape to resist. The families were left in these centers because the weather simply didn't permit further transportation into the interior. And so the families languished until the summer in very, very difficult conditions. In the meantime, the able-bodied family members were sent ahead into the interior to begin work, basically, on the special settlements. Now, remember, the special settlements simply didn't exist. So what happened was these men were sent out to areas that largely hadn't been mapped out, hadn't been prepared, were sometimes almost inaccessible so that people had to walk for days and days just to get there. And what they found largely horrified them. They came upon what had been really pinpoints on a map, decided upon by some regional official. Where nothing was prepared. So this was in the dead of winter. They had to try and set up some kind of temporary housing. They had to clear the land because often the land was covered with forest. The only supply that they had, of course, was timber in great quantity. But all other supplies, tools, and whatnot would have to be over the years brought in from the outside. Now, there had been an expectation that the special settlements, built from scratch as they were, would be completed by September 1st of 1930. This, of course, didn't happen. When the families began their trek into the interior, what they found was half-completed homes, half-completed villages. And it would take months more before they could complete the construction of these villages. In the meantime, the able-bodied would only be working part-time in the villages because the timber industry or other industrial concerns would want their labor. And so it was a constant fight over where these workers would be, whether they would be kept in the special villages to build or whether they would go out and fulfill the state's need in industry.
So you're telling me they arrive at a pinpoint on the map in the middle of nowhere with nothing. They're told that they have to build their own place to live. But, oh, by the way, you can't really spend your time building your place to live because you have to go out here and work for the state in the timber industry instead.
Essentially, this is the case. So there's a constant fight between different institutions in the bureaucracy over where these workers will go. And at various times, different mandates come down requesting that a certain number of workers stay in the villages. But it's a constant battle.
I see.
And it's different in different regions.
What are they doing for food at this time in these places?
Well, theoretically, they're supposed to get rations. And I must say, not a lot of thought was given to feeding these workers. But theoretically, they were supposed to be given rations by the industrial concerns that employed them. So that was another reason why it was hard to keep people building the special settlements, because the rations were outside. They were in the timber concerns, at the mines, and so on and so forth. But that was the theory. Now, in practice, what will happen is that the regions will have to provide these people because they just hadn't thought ahead. And so supplies will have to be scrounged up from the region's reserves in order to feed the workers and then later the families as well.
Okay. So what are conditions like then for the families who are left behind in these collection points while their heads of household or the able-bodied have gone ahead to work on these sort of non-existent special settlements at this time?
Well, in theory, the families were supposed to be housed in barracks, but because the planning literally only started about a month before these people arrived, there wasn't enough time in most cases to put up barracks, so any empty space was cleared to house these people. So the people were in warehouses, in churches, in monasteries, in one case, in a theater. And the conditions were terrible. They lived in places that were damp and dark and dirty. They didn't have enough access to food or to clean water. And within a short time, contagious diseases started to break out. And I'll give you a quote from a doctor who actually was called in the little provincial town of Wologda in the far north. This was a doctor, Lebedev, and he wrote, "A great many D. kulak eyes are accumulating in Wologda. They will be sent on farther north to the most distant, uninhabited, and ruinous places, but they are temporarily housed in Wologda churches, the majority of which already had long been closed to believers. There they build bunks, and the people are packed into the church buildings, and typhus is breaking out. Horrors have begun. The secret police, the OGPU, called me in, and the chief said to me, 'If you don't liquidate the typhus, I will shoot you.' So I went to one of the churches together with some OGPU men. A guard stood at the church, and behind the door, groans and cries. They opened the doors, and there I saw hell, the sick, the healthy, the dying, men, women, old children, old people, children. And the live ones cried out and raised their arms to us, 'Water, water.' I have seen many terrible things in my life, but nothing like this."
I've read many terrible things in studying the Gulag over the years, but these kinds of things still really strike at you when you hear these kinds of stories. The brutality of these places is really just unbelievable. Let me ask you, just to think about a little bit this question. All of this, the horrific nature of the conditions that these people faced, was this all the result merely of bureaucratic chaos, of sort of not having thought this all out ahead, or is there really some intention to cause harm because of a hatred of these kulaks as some kind of enemy, as the embodiment of something that the Soviet state is fighting against?
Probably a mix of both, Steve, which with a large dose of a simple neglect, it was, of course, impossible, unimaginable to settle this size of population in sometimes unexplored and mostly unsurveyed land areas. Moreover, most kulaks arrived empty-handed. They had been fleeced by the state. So the state would have to supply tools, sometimes even skilled workers to aid in the construction. Given the distances involved, the inaccessibility of these remote settlements, and the higher priority of the ongoing industrialization drive, none of that could happen overnight. Was there an added intention to cause harm? I don't think it was necessarily an intention, but I don't think most leaders really cared if kulaks perished. They were, after all, class enemies. Now, that's not to say that there weren't leaders who spoke out and attempted to alleviate the hardships of the policy, some out of humanitarian concerns, most in order simply to save what they considered to be a vital labor force.
Do we have a sense of the mortality rates that there must have been in these kinds of conditions, or any sense of the total number of deaths among these deported peasants?
We have at best estimates, and the sort of generally accepted estimate, which may or may not be near the truth, is that through the course of the 1930s, about 500,000 people died. And we're talking about the kulak population,
right,
the special settlements. Now, if this figure is correct, it amounts to about 25% of the population, a very, very grim figure. But the statistics, especially those on mortality, are very troubling and not necessarily to be trusted. Simple accounting for the population was no possible task, especially in the early days of resettlement when chaos reigned. I should say that the first 2 years, 1930 and 31, were terrible years in terms of mortality. We know, for example, just in the northern territories, 21,000 people died by the end of 1930, a period when there was also extremely high mortality with the famine years of 1932 and 1933. And according to the Russian historian Zemskov, at this time, close to 250,000 people died.
Are mortality rates like this, how substantially different are they from the mortality rates in a Russian collective farm that lived through those same famine years? Are they substantially higher?
I can't really say. If we're just looking at the famine itself, and if we're looking at certain areas like Ukraine and Kazakhstan, which were hit very hard, I would guess for the region as a whole, the mortality rates would be far higher. We're talking about scattered villages in the case of the special settlements, but I can't really give you a general figure on that.
Did conditions improve over time in these places? After this initial period of chaos, did they ever sort of get special settlements built so that people actually had a place to live? Did they get some kind of system of agriculture going to provide food in the localities? Did it all ever settle down?
They did improve over time. I mean, to the extent that some remain today, and in some cases they're used still as penal settlements. But it's necessary to keep in mind that the settlement's populations constantly change, so it took a long time. New waves continue to arrive, even after the high point of 1930-1931. So in 1932, for example, some 71,000 people came. In 1933, something like 268,000 more came. And in fact, in those two famine years, plans had been to send out 2 million, but fortunately that plan didn't come to be, because regional leaders protested. Now, over time, some of the villages became strong and had good harvests and, in fact, were able to feed their villagers. But probably many more villages dwindled along with their populations. Some were closed because they became too small. Some were merged with other settlements. It's hard to give a precise answer to this question, but we can answer it, I think, by saying that by 1935, birth rates began to exceed death rates.
Yes.
Now, of course, in 1937, I should add, the terror would strike, and something like 46,000 special settlers would be caught up in the police manhunt, not to mention the rearrest of all those who had escaped from this earlier.
What kind of work did the deported peasants do once they got to the special settlements?
Well, the largest numbers worked in forestry. They worked cutting down trees and providing wood both for the needs of the Soviet Union and for export. The next areas were agriculture, coal and peat production, and mining, in that order in terms of the number of workers. Some special settlers also worked in the large construction projects like Magnitogorsk.
Mm-hmm.
And as time elapsed, more and more began to work in industry per se.
What proportion of the deported peasants wound up working in agriculture or continuing to work in agriculture?
Well, out of a total of 324,000 roughly, which I have employment statistics for, some 64,000 families, so the 324,000 are families, 64,000 families worked in agriculture. And the next largest figure was coal and peat, followed by non-ferrous metals and gold. And, of course, the largest number of families, some 135,000, worked in forestry.
Okay. So it was approximately 20% would be a rough estimate of the percentage who ended up working in agriculture. It seems interesting to me, I've always kind of wondered this myself, is that you take these kulaks who were supposedly the most prosperous peasants, the most prosperous in agriculture, and why they didn't take them and send them out to largely work in agriculture itself throughout the Soviet Union. And I've always sort of wondered why that was the case. Do you have a sense?
Well, it's a good question, and I mean there is a lot that was certainly counterproductive, to say the very least, in this policy. But I think there was a combination of ideology and let us call it misplaced pragmatism at work in this policy. So-called enemies had to be removed,
mm-hmm.
if possible, re-educated. And at the same time, the state hoped that they would be able to come up with this miracle labor force in these areas where they really needed the raw materials for industrialization, and they couldn't keep free laborers. So the idea seemed to serve two purposes.
Were they still afraid of these kulaks after they had been deported? Did they still think of them did they still think of them as enemies, or did they still think of them as somebody that they had to be worried about, or was it like, you know, we've got them out in these extreme geographic regions and now we don't really have to worry about them so much anymore?
Well, that's a difficult question, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
There continued to be restrictions on them, so I guess in a sense the answer is yes. But the restrictions were there not only to isolate the kulaks, but also to ensure that they stayed in place and could continue to serve as laborers. Now, there's an interesting kind of story here, because in 1931, the kulaks were finally given a term for their sentence, their punishment. And that is, in 1931, the state passed a decree that said 5 years from the time of deportation, if they worked honestly, and this is sort of the language from the times, they could get back their civil rights. Well, 1935 comes along, the first year that the law would come into effect for people deported in 1930, and rather limited numbers, in fact, were allowed to return. So by the time we get to 1936, a total of some 140,000 individuals had been rehabilitated. But at the same time, a decree comes out in 1935, and one in which Stalin is instrumental, which forbids these people to leave. So even the 147,000 who are rehabilitated still have to stay in place. They still have to stay in these regions of exile. Now, complete rehabilitation would only come in 1954, after the death of Stalin. And in fact, by that time, there were very few people to rehabilitate. Many had been rehabilitated through piecemeal legislation or because they served in World War II.
Right.
I should also say that they were only exonerated for their crimes, to use official language, in the early 1990s. So perhaps that's a partial answer to your question. And I should add, too, that the state did not forget these people in 1937 when some 46,000 would be caught up in the Great Terror.
This always reminds me of Yevgenia Ginsburg's memoirs, where she is in permanent exile in the Kalima region, and yet she has been officially granted her civil rights back after the completion of that portion of her sentence. And so this local activist comes and says, you know, we welcome you back into the ranks of the Soviet family. And yet, of course, she still is not allowed to leave that region. So it's like, you know, we give you your civil rights back, but you still can't move back to where you used to live. So, you know, what exactly does this mean to have your rights again if you can only exercise them in a certain way?
Exactly. I mean, it could even be worse, and it could be that not everybody who who ruled over you was in agreement about whether you were rehabilitated or not. So there were some cases where different bureaucracies were in conflict, and one bureaucracy would say that a special settler had been rehabilitated. Another one would have no information, and so they'd have to continue to report to the police. So, you know, it was a terrible situation.
Right. Can you tell us at this point then a little bit, I think it's a really good point for you to tell us a little bit about the mass operations during the Great Terror and the relationship between, you know, so-called rehabilitated or former kulaks and these mass operations?
Well, it's a hard question. And I think we're still only getting data on the mass operations. The one that particularly concerns us is Operation 00447, and that was the one officially titled the operation against, I think, runaway kulaks, social deviants, recidivists. You can correct that for me. But this put the order under which former kulaks were taken. Now, of course, not all kulaks were kulaks, so you know you could get a figure for the number of kulaks actually arrested in under this order. But then you have to ask the question, what does this mean? What does this term mean at this point? Well, what we can say is that of the total number of people who were designated as kulaks and arrested under this operation, roughly, I think it was something like 17% or 46,000 were taken out of the special settlements themselves. I don't have a lot of data on this. Most of it is in the FSB archives, the archives of the former KGB, and we couldn't get at it. In my work in any of the document publication projects and certainly not in my own individual research. We do know from memoirs a number of people would remember that their fathers were taken away, and that was usually the way it was put because the memoirs were written by children, and so they remember the police coming in, taking fathers, and simply not seeing them again. Other people who were subject to arrest were people who had escaped from the special settlements and still had this designation of kulak over their head. And so these people were often targeted always when the operation passed through.
Yeah. I just referring to one part of your book in which you talk about the terror, particularly interested in the part of Order 00447, which describes the categories of kulak elements to be arrested. It talks in particular about, quote, former kulaks who had returned to their villages after completing their sentences and continued to lead active anti-Soviet subversive activity. And so there, what it strikes me as, anyway, in seeing this is the sense that even those who, you know, had achieved the status of rehabilitation and even those who had been allowed to return back to their villages were still seen as, you know, potentially enemies. as, you know, very suspicious as possibly returning to those activities that had led to their deportation in the first place, and therefore possibly to be wrapped up in that wave of terror in 1937 and 38. So, you know, this designation of Kulak seems to have hung around people's necks for quite some time.
Yes, I think that's quite true. And I know from me reading memoirs written many, many years after the fact, people continually talked about how they were afraid. They were afraid for decades after they were rehabilitated, so to speak. They lived in fear. Some people never told their families that they had been de-Kulakized. You know, people could be subject to persecution. So, you know, there are many cases when people were fired from their work once it came out that they had been a family member of a Kulak, mm-hmm. or they had been subject to de-Kulakization. So there was, in fact, reason to fear.
You know, typically when people think of this term Gulag, they have always thought really of the political prisoner spending their time in the forced labor concentration camp, living behind barbed wires, the kind of, you know, the typical scene of the one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, or they've read Yevgeny Ginzburg's memoirs, or maybe more recently they've read Anne Applebaum's book. They haven't typically thought about what you describe as the unknown gulag. They haven't thought about the special settlements. Even a lot of historians haven't thought about it in this way. Can you tell me a little bit, if we try to compare the two worlds, how does life in the special settlements differ from life in the forced labor camps of the gulag?
There are a whole pack of questions.
Well, sure.
To try to answer, and it's a good question. I think I came at this not because I was interested in the Gulag per se, but because I was interested in the peasantry.
Right.
And so I kind of wandered, so to speak, into this other archipelago of the Gulag because I kept wondering what happened to people once they were de-Kulakized. And, you know, we had only the most general sense. And there was a good reason for that, actually at least two good reasons for that. One was that unlike the intelligentsia, which began to write and to talk about the gulag of the concentration camps during the Khrushchev years, the people of my study didn't talk. These were people who just tried to live their lives. They were very, very much ordinary people. Minus their class enemy past, so to speak. And they just tried to live their lives and tried not to think about what their past was. One of the people whose memoir excerpts I have read said, you know, I only started to talk about my past in the special settlement when Yeltsin came into power and when the decrees were passed exonerating us of our crime. My family didn't know before then. So people weren't talking. And of course, by and large, these were people who didn't write memoirs. You know, these weren't members of the intelligentsia. Now, the other reason why we didn't know a lot is, of course, as you and your audience knows, you know, the archives were simply off limits. The term special settlement, settler and special settlement, you know, these were terms that weren't even allowed to be used in the press. So the archives only started to open very, very slowly through the 1990s, and not all of them. So we only slowly began to get information. And that, of course, is one of the chief hindrances. And we couldn't fall back on the rich memoir material we have from the Soviet intelligentsia for the camps. Now, in terms of the differences, there are vast differences. The special settlements basically have no barbed wire. They don't really have guards. They would be administered by a commandant. And because of the remote distances, because of how difficult it was to find personnel, in some cases these commandants administered several special settlements, maybe up to four. So there wasn't a lot of guarding. And so people could move around the area. Indeed, some of them had to be able to go to their place of work, which was outside of the special settlement. Now, initially, people lived in barracks, if they managed to get the barracks built. But within a couple of years, people were given permission to build their own houses so that these special settlements took on more of a semblance of the village, of the peasant village. I should also say, and this is probably the main difference, special settlers were imprisoned as families. This was a family prison, so to speak. You had entire families, including children, including the elderly, including invalids. And this was not the case in the labor camps, where basically you had single people, men or women. I should add as well that in time, by about 1938, young people were allowed to leave to get a higher education in the hope they'd come back and serve as teachers and agronomists and statisticians in the special settlements.
Okay. This raises a whole series of things that maybe we can just take some time with each of them to talk about, because I think they're really fascinating insights into the way people live this experience and to help us to understand what life was like. I guess the first one that I want to focus on a little bit then is this sense that there is no barbed wire. Because if there's no barbed wire and if conditions are as horrible as we've described, why didn't everybody just run away? What is the means of control, that allows them to keep people there? Or maybe did people all just run away? Or how many people ran away?
Well, this is a good question. I mean, I think one of the best means of control was simply the Cayuga. You know, I mean, the climate was terrible. There wasn't necessarily any place to escape to. In some cases, you could go to a village or a city. So, I mean, it wasn't easy to leave. But despite that, people did escape, and they escaped in the tens of thousands. In February 1931, the Ogepeyu, a secret police, claimed that some 72,000 people were in flight. This is a huge number.
Right.
By October, the number had climbed, and that's because you had the summer when roads were much more passable. It was easier to leave. And by October 1931, 101,000 people had escaped. Now, the figures get worse. During the famine years, when there simply was no food, people were leaving sometimes in entire families. And so in 1932, over 200,000 people escaped. And in 1933, the figure was a bit higher. It went up to 216,000 people.
So is this excuse me for interrupting for a second. Is this total number of people escaping each year, or is this the total number who had escaped up to that point?
These are the total number of escapes. For 1932 and 1933, there's a total number of escapes each year.
Wow.
But escapes, by the way, are often repeated. So this doesn't mean that that there are 215,000 people running away in 1933. Some people escape repeatedly.
I see.
And they would be recaptured and they would be brought back. Now, after these years, the state got better at recapturing people. So if in 1932 only about one-sixth of the escapees were recaptured, the figure got to be more like three-quarters in 1935 and higher percentages as the years went by.
Do we have any sense of where people went when they escaped? If they weren't recaptured?
Yeah, it varied. I think most people tried to get to a city because in a city they could be anonymous. And, you know, find employment, get fake papers, and somehow live like that. A really good case in point was Ivan Twardowski. Ivan was the younger brother of the famous poet and Stalin laureate, Alexander Twardowski, who went on to be the editor of Novy Mir, the Sikh journal, during the Khrushchev period, which published so many amazing work,
right,
about the camps. Ivan Twardowski escaped repeatedly, so he was responsible for some of those repeat numbers. He escaped several times with his brother. One time he was recaptured, and the police simply said, go home, go back. So he went back. Unbelievable enough. And this is not the only story of somebody being told to go back and going back. Then he came out again with his brother, and he got work. Eventually he was caught again. At one point he was then sent to a labor camp for Kulak escapees, and so some could be sent to such camps. He was soon released from that camp and sent home again. And then he escaped, finally, one last and successful time, and he ended up in a city. And he managed to get false papers, which then allowed him to get a passport when internal passports were introduced in late 1932, 1933. So, you know, it was possible to get out. I mean, some people that have been back to the village, their villages, and particularly when I've read about this, it's women who go back with children, and they'll find somebody who will put them up. But they live really in great fear of being exposed.
So was there a police force that was dedicated specifically to chasing after escapees? How exactly did this process happen?
Well, it was more like ad hoc groups of police, which would try and recruit any local population, particularly native population in areas where there was a native population. And they might offer rewards to native populations to catch people. Although some special settlers would write that later on that they actually got help from these native populations instead of hindrance. There were also, at this time, special guard units put up at train stations and at markets. And special surveillance at the so-called houses for peasants in some of the cities, which were places that free peasants could come and spend the night. So, you know, they were on the lookout quite clearly.
Okay. I want to talk also a little bit about the commandants. You write a good bit about them in your book, and you note that the commandants were often sort of like dictators in each of their little special settlements, often with almost absolute and very arbitrary authority. And frequently they abuse that authority to reign terror over the deported population. And I just want to quote from your book briefly about one case that really wasn't unlike many others, but one that just really struck me. You write, Commandant Michievsky from Vologodsky County was arrested and sent off to the OGPU for what was described as full counter-revolutionary prize vol or arbitrariness. According to reports, he beat up special settlers, carried out sexual assaults on several women, embezzled money and property from his laborers, and imprisoned people for periods ranging from 7 to 30 days. Several special settlers served as witnesses in his investigation. It turned out that the district officials knew exactly what was going on and indeed were Michievsky's regular drinking partners. The special settlers informed the OGPU that there was lots of wild shooting in the course of these drinking bouts. Now, I have a couple of questions about this, and let's start with the first. I think, first off, many of our listeners may wonder why the Soviet secret police apparatus that was so cruel, that cared so little often for the lives of these deported peoples, why is it, do you think, that they would punish one of their own for the kind of brutality that seems so endemic to this entire system?
Well, it's a good question, and I mean we can extend the question to many other cases. I mean, most of the information about how the famine struck the special settlements comes from the secret police trying to increase food norms and things like that. I mean, are these humanitarian concerns? It's doubtful, but I think the secret police was very, very concerned about maintaining this labor force. So I think there were purely pragmatic reasons to try and keep people alive.
And the second question that I had about this, and given at least the description that you give of this, is that this kind of brutality from the commandants was quite common, and so I think I'm correct in calling it rather endemic, and let me know if that's not the case. But why is it that, do you think, that this happens? Why do the commandants act this way?
Well, you know, I'm not sure whether it's endemic or not. I mean, this is questions I would love to pursue more. And perhaps if officials at the archive of the FSB listen to your podcast, they may invite me to come in and look at their materials and find more information about personnel. It's very difficult, as I think you know from your own research, to to get information about the personnel
right.
who manned the camp.
Right.
So I really cannot make a conclusion about how common this was. I mean, in fact, one tends more to hear about bad commandants than good commandants
mm-hmm.
because their cases come into the legal system. And I think people tend more in their memoirs to remember bad cases and good as well. So it's really hard to say whether it's endemic or not. Now, your other question was, why do they behave this way? And that again is a hard question to answer. I should say that, and I think this was partially the case in the camps as well. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. But people didn't really want to be commandants in these far out places. These were terrible places to live and work. And so often they had to scrape the bottom of the barrel to get officials to go and serve as commandants. So you were starting quite often with less than stellar cadres going out to these places. Some of them, in fact, have been punished in the past, may even have had criminal pasts. So that's an issue to start with. Then, of course, we have to ask, do they believe that the people who they are guarding are enemies and a danger to the state? Again, one can only be impressionistic, but, in some cases, the answer is yes. They don't like these people. They think they're enemies. At the very least, they may not like them because they think they're peasants. I mean, because they are peasants. In other cases, this is not the case. There are some people who wrote about having kind or relatively kind commandants who tried to make the village work, tried to help people. You have a combination of factors, and if that's not enough, the commandants are responsible for fulfilling various production plans, so they have to get people to work. So they are also under certain obligations to the state.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask, sort of similar to my question about escapes, and maybe you'll give me the same answer, which is to say, yes, they escaped, when I ask you why the special settlers would stand for behavior like something from Commandant Michievsky. Now, obviously, in his case, they didn't exactly stand for it. They went to his superiors. My question is did they stand for this kind of brutality on the part of their secret police superiors who were there? And again, I guess the question gets back to, again, and what I'm trying to understand, particularly as compared to the barbed wire enclosed gulag labor camp. What is the means of control in these settlements? How many secret police are there operating here? How are these people being controlled?
Yeah, well, you have the commandant who may or may not be on site because the commandant may be in charge of a number of villages.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have some kind of internal administrative structure which may involve special settlers themselves. Being charged with surveillance, being charged with keeping track of escapes or warning about escapes. So you have some means of internal control. But I think, by and large, we have to keep in mind that we're talking about families. We're talking not about individuals in the camp. So we're talking about people whose families' lives were at stake. To rebel would mean the loss of a laborer, would mean the loss of the head of household. And that could mean death for a family. These are also people who were exhausted and didn't have the strength or the energy to rebel. Quite as often, particularly for that large first category of kulaks, people had been involved back in the village in various kinds of resistance. And, of course, they had already lost everything they had. It was a very hard situation. I'm not surprised that there wasn't more rebellion. Now, that's just not to say that there wasn't rebellion.
Right. And you write about it in your book, of course.
Yeah, initially, particularly in 1930 and 1931, there were some cases of major rebellions when you had a series of special settlements uniting against officials, people just trying to leave en masse. So there were some cases, but really they were in the minority because, you know, these were people, you know, who were shattered, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more then about some of the sources that you use. You talked a little bit about the way in which the special settlers didn't write the same way that the intelligentsia from gulag camps did. You do, though, have a number of tales from survivors of this unknown gulag throughout your book. And I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit more about where they come from.
Well, the tales, some came from letters that were written at the time. So, you know, you can find letters that were addressed to various officials that have a great deal of descriptive information. But most of the recollections only came out from the late 80s and particularly the 90s. And so some of these came out in letters written to Memorial. The Memorial, its central and various provincial branch newspapers, you know, asked people to talk about their experience. So people wrote in often really lengthy reports on what it was like. You also have young researchers going out and tracking people down and talking to them. And then you have some cases of people writing on their own, like Ivan Twardowski, who wrote a memoir, a couple of other memoirs written. Other people, you know, wrote little excerpts. But they only started to write much later than the intelligentsia. They only wrote in the 1990s.
What?
And of course, they had been children. These are people who, for the most part, had memories of their childhood in the special settlements. And I think it's interesting because what that means then is you're getting a distilled memory. You're getting a memory of childhood in the special settlements. So all the memory comes through sort of a child's eye. So it tends to be much more descriptive than analytical, which can be very good at times. But at the same time, there are major omissions and information, like we don't get a lot about what it was actually like working, the work process, or punishment process, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. How do you check the veracity of memory from children so many years after these events have passed? How do you handle that kind of issue in your research?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I think, first of all, you simply have to rely on a large range of sources. And so you're constantly checking, first of all, different types of sources and another. And, you know, you tend to see similar information appearing in letters that were written by special settlers at the time, and bureaucratic reports on conditions in the special settlements, as you get in the memoirs. That's the first thing. So you're comparing types of sources, and then you're comparing the source itself, you know, different memoirs. Are you getting similar kinds of information? And you tend to. You get similar patterns. People tend to remember things in a similar way. It becomes almost formulaic to some extent. In the way they sort of, first of all, they start out by looking at their happier childhood, let's say, before collectivization and decolonization, and then the decollectivization appears like this watershed event, just turning the world upside down, which is how it appeared to them as children.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about some of the difficulties that you faced working in Russia on this topic, particularly the continued inability, as we all know, of getting access to certain archives, the FSB, former KGB archive, most notably. I was wondering if there are any other particular difficulties that you faced working in Russia on this kind of topic in today's climate in Russia.
Well, today is different from 1995,
mm-hmm.
as you well know.
Of course.
I mean, in the 1990s, I think people actually encouraged you in the archives to look at this topic. Now, when I started to do research on it, within a few years, there were very good published document collections on the topic that had come out from Siberia,
mm-hmm.
and the Urals. And so because of that, And because I didn't want to rely only on central archives, I decided to go to the north. And so I worked in Volozhin Arkhangelsk and looked at provincial party and state archives. Now, I was also lucky in terms of central archives because at this time I was involved in a project called The Tragedy of the Soviet Countryside. And it was a Russian project, and we had access to all of the central archives, and that included the FSB archives, the archives of the former KGB. And so although I wasn't allowed to literally go into the reading room there, the project as a whole copied a massive number of documents, particularly for the early volumes in the series, 1928 to 1931. And so that gave me indirect access to those archives. So I was very lucky in that sense. More recently, I think it's become harder to work on this topic. Now, because I haven't continued to work on this topic, I can't say for sure, but I can relate to you a story of what happened to me last summer when I went to Arkhangelsk to work in the archives. Now, I believe that I could have perhaps worked there had I given advance notice, but when I got there, to an archive I had worked before, I was told that now you need FSB clearance in order to work in their provincial archives.
Oh, my gracious.
I never heard about this. And nobody I know had ever heard of this, in Russia or out of Russia. And subsequently, another foreigner had that experience as well. And because he was going to be there for a long time, he did get in. And I didn't have a long time to be there. So, I left, basically, rather disappointed, but nonetheless. So I think that gives you an indication of how things are changing.
Well, Lynn, this has been really fascinating. I really am very thankful for this book. I think The Unknown Gulag will be unknown no longer, and I sure hope everybody gets out and takes a look at it. We'll also look forward to having you answer some questions on the gulaghistory.org blog from the listeners, and I thank you a lot for being the first guest on our podcast series.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Бегу, спотыкаясь, олени. Я знаю, меня ты не ждешь. И писем моих не читаешь. Встречать ты меня не придешь. А если придешь, не узнаешь. Встречать ты меня не придешь, а если придешь...